It was back in 1972 when a friend of mine in Sydney gave me a little newsletter. And I read it and I thought, that's got some interesting information in it. And I was heading overseas and I traveled through many countries and I had many things with me and I took this newsletter with me and more or less carted it around the world. And I got back to Melbourne about 1974. And I remembered this newsletter and I remembered it had a Melbourne address on it. So I pulled it out, got the address, and went down to that address and found this little bookshop upstairs. And in there, the Heritage Bookstore, the League of Rights Bookstore in Melbourne, I found the most incredible array of information on the political or the community field that you could ever imagine. And for someone that really has an extremely strong interest in this area, it was amazing. And I started off my library, and it's gone into a lot of books and tapes and videotapes as the time went on. But that's how it began for me. And that's where I met our next speaker today, Eric Butler. I think Eric's one of the remarkable political figures in Australia. And I wanted to take the opportunity to have Terry Rogers introduce him. Come on up, Terry. Terry travelled up from Melbourne with Eric and has had an intimate relationship in the Freedom Campaign, or whatever you would call it, for a long time. Terry Rogers.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. The most dangerous man in Australia is what Dennis didn't say. That's Mr. Philip Adams' description of Eric Butler. And I dare say to an audience like this that it's probably almost unnecessary to introduce him. Except that Jeremy Lee did, in passing, refer to his going out in 1934. So what we're going to hear this afternoon is a summary based upon over 60 years' practical political experience. I think in introducing him, it's remiss not to make mention of the fact that really he is one half of a team. And I know there would be some here that would know that his wife, Alma Butler, while Eric is out around the traps, she's keeping the home fires burning, literally, and also in the office. To me, both Eric and Alma Butler I consider very close personal friends, as do many of you here. So it's been a privilege over the last 20, 25 years to participate with him and with members of the League and to see what actually motivates them. People very kindly say they are dedicated and they're principled, and all those superlatives. I think, in some respects, although those sentiments are appreciated by people like Eric Butler, that they're unnecessary because they denote really a lack of understanding of what he came out of. And, of course, he comes out of the social credit movement. And on the basis of that, he sees everything in a positive light. As Jeremy Lee said earlier on this afternoon, we mustn't paint too dismal a picture because it is counterproductive, but we must tell the truth. But then give people constructive programs to work to. I think in Australia he is without peer in demonstrating that particular ability. The address today is the election, what comes after it. In delivering that address, we're going to gain the benefit of his insight, his knowledge after those 60-odd years of participating at the coalface, and if you like, collating that to paint us a word picture where we've come from, and more importantly, where we're going to go to. I'll guarantee this, that it will be a positive message, because all of his messages are. Without any further ado, I'd like to call the Advisory National Director of the Australian League of Rights to the podium, Mr. Eric Butler. Would you please welcome him? Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, fellow Australians, first of all, I've got to extend to this audience the apologies of the National Rector, David Thompson, who was scheduled to speak, but pressure of business and other activities forced him to make a very quick visit to Western Australia. So we applied that well-known old army principle of volunteering, you and you, and he said, well, would you go up to Inverell? And that meant a pretty hefty program, because we've had a heavy program, Terry and I, dealing with elections. But here I am, for better or for worse. Now, looking at the title of this address today, I sort of get the impression I'm expect to be some sort of a prophet. And prophesying is a very dangerous business, because as my old friend Sir Raphael Slinter used to say, if ever you prove right, no one will ever remember, but if you prove wrong, well, no one will ever forget. However, I'd just like to just say that we're not going to be able to make any predictions about the future unless we do look at the past and the back of where we come from. So perhaps I should say this about the Australian League of Rights. This is the 50th anniversary since it was formed. That is a record for any political movement in Australia. We've seen large numbers of governments of all types come and go, seen all sorts of politicians come and go, and the League of Rights is still existing, much to the horror of some people that we'll see in a few minutes. It's correct, as Derry Rogers said, the League comes out of the social credit movement. I just want to touch on that for a few minutes, because with great respect to all of you, got your different interests, ranging right across health problems, many other problems. If you'll go right back to that particular genius, Douglas, and what he predicted was based on the scientific approach, where he did demonstrate there's a massive flaw in the system. And it didn't matter what you did about the system, you're going to have problems. As we all know, of course, conservation's the in thing today. Douglas was talking about that 70 or 80 years ago. Said you can't work the system, this full growth idea, unless you're going to have those problems. All the problems we've got with farming all come back to the same thing. So here we had a man who was able to predict very accurately what was going to happen. And so as early as the 1920s, in fact, the guns had hardly stopped smoking from the First World War, and there was talk about that new world, Douglas was able to predict with absolute accuracy this was simply part of an ongoing process. And so far from moving into a new civilization, unless the policies being pursued were being reversed, that civilization was going to die. And that was dramatic stuff in those days. Well, over the years that have followed, we have seen, in fact, what exactly he predicted, that if you're going to pursue a policy of centralizing power with finance and debt as the main instruments, the end result is inevitable. You don't need to be brilliant. You just seem to understand that. You can say the end result is completely inevitable. So the Great Depression, the World War, and everything else was all predictable. So I'm going to predict today, to get right to the point, because people are going to ask what's going to happen with the Howard government, here a change in Australia, well, nothing's going to happen except we're going to continue to go down the road we've been going for the last half century ago. One can predict that with absolute certainty. The last time we had this sort of dramatic movement in this country was back in 75. You'll remember that quite colourful character called Gough Whitlam. And eventually Gough Whitlam was sacked. Not, of course, as mythology would have it, by the Governor-General, but by the Australian people, when the Governor-General, in essence, used the Constitution, said, you ought to have a say. And we had a say, and so it had enough of you. Now, all my friends told me at the time about the new leader, this bloke called Malcolm Fraser, who'd managed to get the leadership of the Liberal Party by elbowing Sir Billy Snedden aside, suffering from what our friend McDermott calls the ego mania. People said, well, it must be better. It couldn't be any worse. Well, I was one of those, and it's on record, you can read it, an article I wrote just a few months after Malcolm Fraser came to office. In fact, I invited people to put it up on top of their mantelpiece or the refrigerators and take it out later. Fraser government already on the road to disaster. It wasn't because I was some genius. It's simply because I understood what was taking place. I might say I lost a lot of my friends when I made that prediction because they said he must be better than Gough Whitlam. No, I said he could be even worse. And he proved worse. Now, one of the reasons I assessed Malcolm Fraser was on the same basis I do assess a lot of other people. Old-fashioned approach. I'm one of those who believe in assessing my fellow man on the basis of what I call character. Character. And you see, I'd known Malcolm Fraser since a boy. I knew him before he went to university. I knew when he'd come back. And this man lacked what I call character. I regret to tell you that I'm going to make the same prediction about John Howard. It's not a personal assault on John Howard. John Howard can't help his background, but it's simply not in the man. And if you think that, I'd like you to just look for a few minutes at his record. We can only judge on the record. And go back, of course, to Malcolm Fraser and the disastrous years we had under a government, had a big majority. Could have done a lot of the things that should have been done, but never did them. Back went the other way. The debts piled up, the taxation went up. In fact, John Howard has got the reputation of being, you might say, one of the worst treasurers we ever had in this country. Remarkable performance. So I'll tell you a little true story about John Howard from a friend of mine. He was a senior member of the automotive industry, imported all those European cars, and his job was to go up to Canberra to deal with the bureaucrats. And the bureaucrats told him on many occasions that John Howard at that time was their most valued minister, the one that they admired the most. Why? You could wind him up, put him the data, put him in front of the television. Mistake. It was John Howard. John Howard's the man that when someone persuaded him we ought to have an end to a certain type of taxes, fringe benefit taxes. I think he genuinely believed it, so where he went up there to Queensland, some of you recall. And the foolish man thought he could get blokes out there working in those industries if he took their fringe benefits away. And he was amazed to find they didn't see it that way. And one fact, one chap put a headlock on him and threw him out of the pub. And he was even looking astonished he was thrown out of the pub. He said, this doesn't seem right. He also tried to impose a form of tax that we've all forgotten about, the most iniquitous ever tried in this country, taxing books and literature. You've all perhaps forgotten that. And he was deadly serious about it. Now, you can't deny he's a serious man, very serious. That makes him so dangerous. And you look at what's behind him. Three of my friends in Brisbane were clergymen. And they took a deputation down to Canberra to see John Howard. And they thought all they had to do was to explain to him reasonably the effect that this would have on Christian literature, magazines. And all he had to do was explain it to him and he'd see it. I met them when they went back to Brisbane. They're in a state of shell shock. They'd never met a man like this in their life. It was like talking to that door. It didn't matter what argument they put up. No good showing what it'd do to literature or anything else. Didn't make any difference. He'd been programmed. It was going to go ahead. John Howard. So that's his record there. And we also should remember that during his period with Malcolm Fraser, he introduced an idea, or he promoted the idea, which of course we've got to discuss as we look at our future. Very important idea. When he was Treasury, he had a man as his advisor. Brilliant man, as advisors go, he must be brilliant. He worked for the International Monetary Fund. And you know some brilliant ideas have come out of that place. And this man advised John Howard for quite a while. He'd been a top official with the International Monetary Fund. And his name? John Hewson. And John Hewson persuaded him, in the brave new world that was emerging, we need, as a first major step, we need to deregulate the banking system. And John Howard spent a lot of time trying to persuade even the Fraser government they should do that. But in those days, they did have a few more sensible characters there that said, well, this is a revolutionary idea and we won't go for this. Well, just before, and not long before, the famous 1983 election, when we got rid of poor old Malcolm, you'll remember him going out with tears in his eyes, and we had a new star emerging. Well, two of them, really. There's a chap called Bob Hawke. He'd managed to elbow poor old Bill Hayden aside to get the top job. And we also had the man he brought on and soon became known as the world's greatest treasurer. His name was Paul Keating. Now, before Paul Keating was elected, he was a great opponent of deregulating the banking system. Don't take my word for it. You can read about it. He correctly pointed out, if you deregulate the banking system, you'll allow the foreign banks to sweep in. We'll lose control of the country. This is Paul Keating. But then you see, as soon as he'd been elected, he made that famous mecca, which presumably all treasurers must make. In fact, John Howard will probably have to make it, or whoever he appoints, perhaps Mr. Costello. And they go to that mecca called Wall Street, the centre of what we loosely call international finance. And there you pay your respects, like the Mohammedans going to Mecca. And lo and behold, he came back a changed man. Those of you who take the Christian revelation seriously are well aware of the famous story of being taken up on the high mountain and the dangers there and what Christ said about it. Gets too heady up there. People are overcome with it. The power. The temptation. Well, I'm reliably informed that Paul Keating didn't even go to the top of the mountain. He even just got to the foothills. It was too much for him. And he came back and he announced we were going to have the deregulation of banking. And what did John Howard say to this? He complained he's stolen my policy. Well, it wasn't really John's policy. I had to come further back from that. And if you read an article in The Australian just before the elections, an in-depth, one of those in-depth interviews with John Howard. So they went through it and different things, you know, the little petty stuff, till the finish. But is there one thing you could say about Paul Keating that he's done that, because he must have done some good things on behalf of Australia? No hesitation at all, his reform of the banking system. So we have John Howard, before he becomes Prime Minister, telling a top journalist the greatest achievement, the greatest contribution that Paul Keating made was to implement the program of deregulation banking. So that's where we are, my friends, and so unless someone can explain to me with mathematics that are outside my knowledge how we can get ourselves out of debt and taxation and centralisation by going deeper into it, I'd be very pleased to hear that. It is impossible. So that is why we can predict here today not in a pessimistic mood, but simply facing the facts of life. It's rather like saying, well, if you're going to jump over that cliff, we can say with certainty you're going to reach the bottom. So I can say today, if you're going to continue to go down the road we're going, all we've got's a different public relations team. The results are going to be disastrous. That doesn't mean that the disaster is something that should force us into a corner where we shrivel up and say it's all hopeless. Because the battle in which we really are engaged is a very long-term one. It started way back. In fact, it started back to over 2,000 years ago. Still continuing. And we're simply all, as I see it, participants in that struggle. There have been ups and downs in the battle. But the truth is one of the absolutes that never changes. There are absolutes. Now, the absolutes are the finest thing we've got to hold on to. Absolutes. Now, I know that's not very fashionable today to talk about absolutes. But you can take it from me, there are absolutes. Such as, for example, if you centralize power, you can take it from me what it does to the human being. It produces the very worst in him. So decentralization of power is essential for salvation. Or you can say without fear of contradiction, if you jump over the cliff, it'll be disastrous. The law of gravity is an absolute. And I always like to quote that great Christian philosopher and wit and poet, one of my favourites, G.K. Chesterton, who said, you know, the man who jumps over the cliff not only violates an absolute called the law of gravity, he demonstrates the truth of the law. Only a poet could say that. That's a profound insight. And really, in one sense then, my friends, as I put it, the plight of the world today is the only hope we've got. People say, that's a bit difficult. No, it's not. The plight of the world is the result of violating absolutes. That means there are still absolutes there, and when you can humble yourself enough to go back to the absolutes, the way out. If there were no absolutes, then our position would be hopeless, wouldn't it? That is what I call the good news. We ought to always hold on to that. I do, at least. Now, as a result of what's being pushed upon us, we've, during this recent election, seen some remarkable developments. I want to just touch on those and just say a few words about activities the League has been engaged in, and you'll gather from my remarks that, because of the time constraints, and I'm always very conscious of those with Dennis Stevenson, painful experience to be cut off in the middle of a sentence. But I just want to say to you what I'm telling you gathers from our experiences and what we've seen and what we know. And I want to tell you the League of Rights, from the point of view of political know-how and intelligence, would have more knowledge than any other movement this country put together. So we were able to say to some of those players during the recent election what was going to happen. And it certainly did happen. So some of you are involved, for example, in campaigns concerning a very, very major issue called immigration. And I agree completely. Immigration is a most basic issue. Again, you go back to that genius C.H. Douglas, who said as long as you've got a homogeneous society and give them time, they'll eventually provide some answer to their problems. But if you fragment them with multiculturalism and make it the business of disaffected groups to turn it into a profession to exploit the grievances, you'll blow that society up. Now, that's what's been happening all over the world. And we've been the victims of it. Multiculturalism's got to be seen as part of the bigger program. It's not just some minor part, a major part. Now, fortunately, in this country, we're not down the road as far as, shall we say, the Americans, where it is blowing up, as witness the Patrick Buchanan phenomenon. So it's become a major issue. And it's obvious a number of groups took it up. Give them full marks. Groups like the Australians Against Further Immigration. People like Dr. Spencer and his lovely wife. Dennis McCormick, give them all full marks. They did tremendous work in trying to raise this issue up. And they managed to get the ear of at least one federal politician. We'll come back to him in a few minutes, Graham Campbell. They went further than that. They went out to the coalface and they ran a few campaigns, particularly in the field of by-elections. And the polling was very interesting. At this stage, I want to say something, because people say, well, look, the League of Rights is not supposed to be involved in party politics. What were you doing in some of these matters? The League is a service movement. And where we see a campaign, or we see a government, or we see a politician that's advocating a policy we believe is correct, well, then we think he ought to be offered support. I suppose the classic case was in Queensland. Some of you from Queensland recall this. Back in Joe Bajelke Peterson's day, and people said, what's the League of Rights backing Joe Bajelke Peterson? Well, they're not in party politics. We weren't backing Joe so much as the fact he'd come forward with a program. Very interesting policies he had. Establishing a state bank and much else. And we had the incredible spectacle there where the League of Rights was running its program, endorsing Joe, and the official party was pretending we didn't exist. That was the campaign which gave Joe an absolute majority. We saw it as service to those policies, not a, I can tell you, a support of the National Party as such. So we've supported this group, but all the time drew attention to the problems that were there. We did surveys. We were involved, as my friend Terry Rogers, who's the state director of the League in Victoria, knows. We did an on-the-spot survey. We provided people worked in the Kooyong Bay election. We did the canvassing, we did much else, and we processed the whole thing, and we were able to tell them what people were thinking. We discovered there, for example, by looking at the second preferences votes, believe it or not, in Kooyong, blue ribbon liberal seats, 9% of the liberals were giving their second preference the Australians against further immigration. And I want to tell you, during this recent campaign, and now we come to the nitty-gritty, because people say to me, well, what happened? The federal elections. Well, I'll tell you very simply what happened. John Howard didn't win the elections. Paul Keating was voted out. As simple as that. The Australian electors were so incensed by the arrogance and much else, they could not get to the polls quickly enough, could not be get quickly enough to vote him out. Paul Keating was one of the few that didn't know this. He hadn't heard about it. And so we were able to predict that. So I wasn't surprised. Now, in one of the electorates where we're very heavily involved, and to show you what we can do, we had 72 on-the-spot people manning those booths, and that's no mean effort. But people that know what they're about, asking the right questions, and we discovered this. We discovered these people agreed completely with what the immigration people were saying, but don't let's worry about that at the moment. Let's get to that polls and get rid of this bloke Keating, then we can come back and deal with that. We even had the example of, and we won't go into names because that would cause problems, with some of John Howard's own Liberal candidates telling us privately. They agreed with us completely. In fact, one candidate's husband said, if it weren't for the fact my wife's running, I'd be working for you. There was no problem about that. And so as the campaign developed, we had some remarkable developments, which you know, are now become a major issue in Australian politics. A major issue. And so in order to get a proper assessment of that, we turn to that Bible of the internationalists. Not everybody reads it, because a specialist journal, the Financial Review. And the Financial Review tells you in its major editorial following the elections, racism was the worst part of the election. And it goes on and tells a lot of other interesting things, and tells John Howard what he's got to do. He's got to clean up the coalition parties and wait for it. Yes. He's got to now rethink his whole question concerning the racial vilification legislation, and he's got to go back and re-strengthen it and bring it forward so that Australia can face the world again as a decent sort of a nation where we won't have this disease called racism. Interesting, isn't it? What we've seen is particularly in Queensland, a manifestation of what is taking place. Now, first of all, you'll recall the famous de-wogging comment. We incidentally had a very interesting little episode in my booth. A lady come along and she couldn't go in to vote, but she had a sense of humour. She was of Dutch background and said, why can't she vote? Well, she said, I haven't been de-wogged yet, she said. You see, some people see the funny side of things, but not these ideologues. They're so deadly serious. So you had those incidents. Then, of course, we had Bob Catter. But the major problem was this bloke, Campbell. And even worse than that was the fact that Campbell seemed to have got himself in with some dangerous people. In fact, seemed to be listening to them far too much, that League of Rights, and they're very bad news. And it's no secret, we did give him a lot of advice. Now, a lot of people have asked me, well, why didn't he run for the Senate where I had more chance of winning? So I want to tell you something about Campbell. This is a personal testimony. I think he's one of the most remarkable politicians I've ever met. Why do I say that? Because he's honest to the stage. He's his own worst enemy on occasions. He is quaint in his belief you should keep promises. Right at the height of the campaign we were about to kick off, we had a meeting down in Sydney, and it was quite clear Mr. Keating was moving towards resolving his problems. He'd already got rid of our friend, sacked him. Time's up, mate. And we know Mr. Keating had to say that because he'd got his orders from a bloke called Mr. Lieber, who said it's time to get rid of that bloke. So, in the middle of this, he said, well, I've got to go off to America. Good God, what? Go there. Well, he said, I'd made a promise last year to a group of congressmen, very important, that I'd go. So you make a promise, you go. And I've seen that time and time again. He is naive in some of those areas. A bit like Joe Bajelke was. But a bit more hard-headed than that. So he was the target. There's no question. So people say, why didn't you run for the Senate? Because he said when I ran the last time in Kalgoorlie, I'd promised the electors I'd represent them. And it's certainly true. I've been sacked by Mr. Keating on the orders of Mr. Liebler. But I made that promise. So it's going to be a hard battle. I should first of all go back and get their opinion. And I want to tell you today, the amount of money that was spent in the Kalgoorlie election was astronomical. And it didn't come from the Labor Party because they weren't capable of raising that sort of money. Campbell was seen as that rare sort of a person with all his faults, and I want to finish on this note later, some positive ideas. A rare person who emerges in a crisis, it becomes what I call the coalescing point. He becomes the catalyst. Graham Campbell's the first to admit he's no orator. He's no great charismatic figure. Then what's he got that attracts so many people to him? He simply is saying in everyday language what a great majority of people feel. That's what he's doing. That's why he's so successful. He's that catalyst. And I regret to say, and I've assessed and I've known the Canberra scene for a long time, I know of no one else down there. I know of no one. And he knows of no one. In any of the parties, any of the groups, that can fulfill that role today. See, if you go back in history, there are periods when you need that catalyst. Just after the Second World War, all the anti-socialist parties were all flumming around. There was also, you might go back in that period, there was dozens of them, really. There was one man emerged who was the catalyst, who had the respect of all of them, and he was Bob Menzies. Whether you agree with him or disagree with him, he was the catalyst. Bob Menzies. Now, we haven't had a Bob Menzies for a long time. And I'd have to say Graham Campbell's the nearest to fill that bill since we've seen in this country. And I've been around a long time. He says himself, modestly, there may be someone out there that can do this better than I can do it. I don't want to be this central figure. That's what I like about him. He's modest. Doesn't pretend to be what he's not. So he's predicting we're on a pretty interesting path. One of the television interviews he did, and he's good on those one-liners. I think you all like his one-liners. I like them. When after he'd been sacked, he said, well, that's amazing. He said, here I'm sacked for telling the truth, and Carmen Lawrence is paid for telling lies. He's even prepared on television to admit he'd had a very long lunch and was slightly under the weather. And someone said, well, that'll upset all the old ladies. It didn't upset anybody. People said, what we're seeing is a real bloke there, not one of those cardboard things. This bloke's real. He is real. He's a man's man. He knows what it's like to handle a crowbar in 120 degrees fencing. He's done all those things. He carries the Aboriginal vote with him. And I notice with some interest my friend Bob Catt has got the majority of that too. These racists seem to get the support of these people. I wonder, can these ideologues humble themselves enough to sit down and ask, why do these people vote for them? And then finally, of course, this episode, and I think we ought to just comment on it, Mr. Chairman, if you'll give me a moment. It's one of those miracles. It's rather like the Emperor's new clothes. And everybody's going around, you know, and trying to pretend. And the little boy says, but Mummy's got no clothes on. Do you know that happened up in Oxley? The electors got up because that housewife, Pauline Hanson, got up and said what everybody said. Rah! That's, we all believe that. Why didn't someone say that before? And horror of horrors, she's voted into office. And presumably those electors are so terrible, they're going to be now re-educated. Further education. We've not done the job, says these people here. Big job ahead. Now, that's where you are at the moment. But as our friend the Financial Review admits, it's not going to go away. And I'm going to tell you it's not going away because we discovered during the election it's not going away. The great majority of common sense Australians have had enough. Now, what they've got to do is find some expression to this. And all I'm going to say, you've all got your ideas, whatever they may be. But I can tell you this, and I'll leave it at that. I'm going to predict with absolute certainty, because I think I'm a little privy to what is being thought, I think you're going to see a different type of political movement emerge about a couple of months' time around that bloke called Graham Campbell. So that's where we are, and that's just a few comments, random comments, you might say, as I see it. But the good news is we're still here. I'd like to congratulate, sir, the forum continuing on. I think tremendous service. All sorts of people can come and spread their ideas, and that's a tremendous achievement. We're still not in the position where you can't meet. We've got a lot going for us. And finally, might I say, a personal testimony, I really did enjoy, I hope you all enjoyed, that address by that National Party member, that state boy. That was tremendous stuff, tremendous material, when he told you about that constitution we got. My friends, that's the greatest gift we've got. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. It's all been done for you. Your forebears have done it for you. Let's take it out and brush it up and use it. Thank you. You going to have some questions?
If you'd be good enough to come to the centre microphone, we'll ask Mr. Butler if he's good enough to answer questions. That's the difficulty when you speak so well. I think we should understand that Mr. Butler has got an encyclopedic knowledge, and if you have any questions, first of all, on the League of Rights, its goals, its history, its plans, its people, what it's doing around Australia, you can ask that, or any of the specific insights he's had into political parties or people in history. Mr. Butler's been a very close view, or has had a very close view of the political sphere for a long time. Yes, John.
Mr. Chairman, Eric. Just a little question. What is your opinion on the subversion of the Australian Constitution? How in the name of God did these people get away with what they're doing? There should have been treason trials in this country over the last few years, and they haven't happened. I wonder why.
Well, the short answer, and that's a question we're often asked. It's part of the problem. The subversion's taken place over a long period of time. And the difficulty for anybody like myself trying to warn people was that it seems so outlandish. That could never happen here. And perhaps I can take a minute, Mr. Chairman, and tell you again a true experience. It's part of Australian history that during the Second World War I was one of the great adversaries of Dr. Bert Ebert and the great power struggle. But as during that period I was researching and I was discovering this fellow and some of his friends, Dr. Harold Laskey of the London School of Economics and others, had looked at the problem of how you're going to get around a set of rules where you've got to come to the people and get them to express an opinion. And they'd come to the conclusion you'd never get the change that way. You've got to find some way you can get around it. And they looked at the external powers. Bert Ebert and Laskey were the first to start promoting that idea. It was like a little cloud away in the distance that time, and no one took it any seriously. I started when I left the army at early 46. I was giving some lectures on this, trying to warn people about this question you raised. And you know the reaction of most of my colleagues? Poor old Eric. He's been up in the islands far too long. He's a little floppo. He's trying to tell us we're going to reach the stage they'll be tearing up the Constitution. We won't even be consulted. Poor chap. That could never happen. It took a long time before they did realise it was happening. It's a long process. All we're going to do is keep warning people, giving them information. So it's been a long process of subversion.
Yes, sir. Mr. Butler, in view of the vast 22% increase in the vote for Pauline Hanson, being the racist that she is, according to Mr. Howard, would you advocate that that would be a way to bring Mr. Howard back to addressing the native title issue by suggesting the same racist overtones to him?
I think that the lady, or the electors, or the lady, because she's been the catalyst, has opened up a Pandora's box. And you can see John Howard's problems. After all, he didn't, as he said, not like that weak-kneed National Party that couldn't handle Catter or that other bloke up in Cairns. Well, I might I just tell you this. The Liberals won up there, but he's even worse, privately, than the National Party bloke that got beaten. He's worse. There's a lot of racists, I can tell you now, in John Howard's party, but he wasn't going to tolerate that, so that lady was out, not even 24 hours. I've sacked you. And the electors of Oxley say, well, have you? And they gave the answer. What's he going to say to that lady when she arrives? I like that question of the night. Well, he'll have to get used to me because I'm going to be looking at him in the chamber for the next 3 years. This has lifted the box. And John Howard's got to live with this problem. You're right. This whole question is now in the open. Now in the open. It's now, they can try and clamp down on it. The voices are starting to raise, and the interesting is, people have been too frightened up in the land. You don't mention these things. Do you know just the courage of that one woman and a few others has taken the lid off it? People now are feeling, well, we can bloody well talk about these things. I'm not going to be stopped from talking. It's created a new climate. I'm already feeling a lot better myself. I can say a few things I didn't like saying before. Yeah, it's a new ball game. Yes, John.
Mr. Butler, you gave support to Andrew Fisher in relation to the National Party and their support for the Statute of Westminster. Yeah. Could you give us your view on the Statute of Westminster and its relationship to Magna Carta?
Look, might I say with great concern for people go into these areas. I agree with what people are saying. We're going to live in the real world, what's taking place now. And some of these people get... You don't need to tell me about Magna Carta. I was lecturing on Magna Carta and I was 14 years of age. I know its importance. But I want to tell you, in the real world today, it's not much good getting up in the courts and trying to talk. the judges about Magna Carta haven't heard about it. They've come out of a new background. The whole climate's changed, the same as I was listening to my friend McSweeney over there. The judges have changed. The whole of our society's changed. And what to you is important, it's no longer the case with them. We've got to re-educate our society. We've got to go back to the grassroots. And the good news is there's a ferment taking place that we can now work with. But don't expect so much from some of these people. And what's clear to you about Magna Carta, the Statute of Westminster, and much else, you're talking double Dutch to some of these people. I know because I've been there and tried it.
Yes, next question.
Mr. Butler, you talk about re-educating the people, but through the media, the League of Rights is painted as an absolutely criminal, Nazi type organisation. Do you have any plans to clean up your image?
Well, all... all I can say is that's the good news. You know, I would really start to get worried if the mass media ever suddenly came out and we're getting some good things said about the League. I'd say, where have we gone wrong? And I'll let you into a little secret. Because being a Christian, I don't believe anybody's beyond the pale. And believe it or not, this will rather tickle some of you. I've engaged Philip Adams. First of all, that famous article, Toxic Sludge, was highly slanderous. And my lawyer was told by the Australian lawyers, well, if Eric Butler wants to go to the courts, we'll take him to the highest courts in the country. It'll be very, very expensive, and we'll drag him there. Look, I was advised a long time ago by one of the greatest lawyers we've got in Victoria. Eric, he said, don't worry yourself. What the hell they say about you, as long as your wife doesn't believe it, just don't worry about it. You can't beat them there. That's the wrong battlefield in which to fight. You'll exhaust yourself. And I've seen good men exhausting themselves. I don't propose to do that. But I thought I'd conduct a little different exercise. So I wrote to my friend Philip Adams, and I said, well, look, I couldn't get any satisfaction with the Australian. I heard he was a fair and decent bloke. Perhaps he'd give me a bit of a hand, get my letter published. Well, that's opened up a very interesting correspondence. I want to tell you, I believe that Philip Adams is a man that's not quite sure of himself. I believe there are chinks there. I did suggest we ought to have a public, you know, debate. We could have a big collection and a charity could win. Well, he didn't know about us old codgers, but it's gone on from there. We're really friendly. You know, Eric, old boy, it's great to hear from you. But now it's petering out because we're starting to get down to some of the nitty-grit. You never know, do you? So I really enjoy the game. You must notice I'm not worried too much. In fact, as I say, quite frankly, the League's own records is its greatest criterion, and the fact of the caliber and sort of people that support it.
Harry, could I make the point, particularly in lieu of that question? A lot of people are well aware of the good works that the League has been involved in over the decades, but some people aren't. We have. Could you perhaps use 10 minutes to give us an understanding of some of the things the League has achieved? I think it's useful to put on the record.
Right, okay. Well, stakes. Somebody asked, well, what can one person do? This was being raised during the suggestion we ought to politically try and do something with the Senate. Because that part of the system does permit a breakthrough. Now, many years ago, now all of you here today, I'm sure all of you here today, appreciate the fact you haven't got death duties. Okay? I wonder how many know how that came about. It came about because many years ago, a bloke in Western Australia called Sid Negus got a bee in his bonnet and said the death duties are a wretched form of tax. In fact, they're a form of Marxism and they ought to be abolished. And he campaigned only on one issue. The League of Rights over there supported him. It was a double disillusion, so the quota required wasn't very big. I think he only got 7% of the first primary vote, but then the preference came in, and lo and behold, Sid Negus was at Canberra. He was in the Senate. That was the first step. But now we come to that practical aspect where the League has done work that you never hear about, the expertise. And we said, well, look, this thing's nationwide. It's no good in trying to start in West Australia. Let's bring him over to the East. And we ran a whole series of lectures for Sid Negus on the subject of death duties until we got him up to Queensland. And no doubt you're already guessing. He was introduced to some bloke up there
who said, golly.
Golly, he said, if I introduce that in Queensland, every other state's got to follow, because otherwise they'd all shift their assets to Queensland. Joe Jolke Peterson took the step because Sid Negus was introduced to him. This is a bit of history, sir. So people say, well, what good's the league done? A number of other examples can be given of what we did. For example, I'm trying to write my memoirs. Don Shipp won't like this part of it. Don Shipp, one time, as you know, was the chairman of that party that was there to keep the bastards honest. And when John Howard brought down that wretched bit of taxation on books and literature, he had no difficulty getting it through the lower house, but it was a problem of the Senate. Don Chip had the balance of power, and he was vacillating. What should he do? Well, it so transpired that in Gippsland, a big luncheon took place. There were businessmen, all sorts of people there, you know, a good cross-section, and Don Chip was invited as guest of honour. He said afterwards he suspected there was sort of something about that dinner. The questions seemed pretty matured, yet businessmen, professional men. But he did open up, and in the course of what he said as a politician, you know, which we knew, but it was good to have it confirmed, and this is something I'll pass on to you. If you get six letters on a question, you start to take notice. If you get 60 letters, that's really serious. You'd better sit up and take notice. That was carefully noted. That weekend he went back, I think he had a meeting up in Yarragonga or somewhere, and do you know that by some strange chance, someone found his telephone number, where he was staying, and he got inundated that weekend with telephone letters and calls about this tax. And on Monday morning, he agreed, yes, the tax was iniquitous, we're going to vote against it. I don't need to tell you who organised the luncheon. And so it could go on. There's many, many episodes in the history of the league, of the work that's been done. We don't ask for any credit because we're not in that game. We've conducted, I'm interested in your subjects here today, health subjects, the organic movement, terribly important. I'm very much interested in all those matters. Providing service for people. And perhaps first but last but not least, Mr. Chairman, there was a period, some of you farming background will recall that period, get bigger or get out, remember that? That was the thing, go for it, growth, the big thing. Well, I'll introduce you to a few of people in the league down in Melbourne, successful businessmen today, who said the greatest thing that ever happened to me was I met the League of Rights just the moment when my engineering business was growing nicely and the accountant was saying, this is the way to go, get bigger, put more staff on, and I heard a lecture from the League of Rights. And this character said that might be the wrong way to go. It might be a track that's going to lead to disaster. You might be better to stay moderately small or decent than go that way. And I can introduce you to hundreds of people around this country who'll tell you, I wouldn't be farming, I wouldn't be running a business if I hadn't met the League of Rights and got that sort of advice. Those are just some of the things I pass on to you, without boasting about it, because we're not in the boasting business. Anybody else?
Thank you, Eric.